from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Call them what you will, white supremacists, white nationalists, alt-right, racists. Since Charlottesville, they say they're riding high, coming out of the shadows, boosted by all the news coverage, encouraged, they say, by the president. There are 9 more rallies that could happen this coming weekend. This isn't a show, folks, and it isn't over. This hour on Point, the white supremacist movement, who's in it, where it's headed, and how this nation responds. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What do you see in this movement? The old KKK? A new polo shirt? Racism? What's the difference? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Before we dig in on what this movement is about, we turn to Janelle Ross in Washington, political reporter for The Washington Post. She co-wrote today's story in The Post on how mayors across the country are preparing to deal with upcoming nationalist rallies. You can find a link to her piece at our website, onpointradio.org. Janelle, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So what kind of steps are mayors taking where? I'm looking at this list of where rallies are planned, and it's long, 9 cities on here.
That is true. That is true. I think that it is, we should say, very difficult to say for sure where anything is going to happen.
Yes.
But there are places where there are rallies that are planned. There are also communities that have decided that they would like to take action or move forward with plans that were already in place to remove Confederate statues, which I think some people suspect might make them also places that those opposed to removing these statues would want to gather.
So, I mean, we've heard some making very, very clear statements. This was the mayor of Boston, Marty Walsh, where a big rally is planned this weekend, or a rally anyway. We'll see how big it is. But he was responding to the Charlottesville events over the weekend, sent a message to hard-right protesters planning to demonstrate in Boston. Here he was, Mayor Walsh.
Boston does not welcome you here. Boston does not want you here. Boston rejects your message. We reject racism. We reject white supremacy. We reject anti-Semitism. We reject the KKK. We reject neo-Nazis. We reject domestic terrorism. And we reject hatred. And we will do every single thing in our power to keep hate out of our city.
There of Boston, Marty Walsh, where there's a free speech rally scheduled for this weekend. But they've got a permit, do they not, Janelle?
They do indeed have a permit, which, of course, gives them the ability to peaceably assemble. Anything that moves beyond that point is not necessarily permitted or protected.
The city laying down strict conditions, you report. No sticks, no weapons, no backpacks even. What other kinds of steps are mayors taking as they look at what happened to Charlottesville?
I think the thing that seems to be most common is that you have a, there seems to have been an onslaught of cities around the country where there have been very specific steps taken in just the last few days to remove or relocate Confederate statues. Of course, I think most people are familiar with the fact that in Baltimore, the Confederate statues in place in that city for many, many years were hauled away overnight on Tuesday, or I suppose between Monday and Tuesday. In Birmingham, they have boxed up, essentially built a plywood box around that city's Confederate monument. In Richmond, there is a mayor who had been an advocate of placing additional context onto, plaques and panels around the existing statues. That city has quite an array of Confederate monuments and remembrances.
As we can imagine, the former capital of the Confederate South, yeah.
Indeed, indeed. And he has said that, in fact, he has shifted his opinion and has moved towards being in favor of removal and all that that process might entail, because he believes that these statues have become a rallying point for groups that the city does not want to invite.
Birmingham, Alabama, in kind of a bind, you report, because Alabama state law penalizes cities with a $25,000 fine if they violate a prohibition against removing monuments. State law against taking them away. So they've got, plywood and a tarp around it.
That's true. And there are many cities that also find themselves in similar complicated situations. In Memphis, where the mayor has been working to try to remove Confederate statues since he first took office in 2016. There is a state law that makes removal rather difficult. At minimum, there's got to be a waiver given by a state historical commission. There have been a number of legal wranglings and so forth, and that process is ongoing. And as a city official told me there yesterday, this is a city where that is 63% Black and where there has been very little, if any, local opposition to removing these statues. But at this point, it is state law that is keeping them in place.
Janelle,
there are similar rules in Kentucky as well.
Colleges moving too here. You report Texas A&M and University of Florida canceling events tied to white nationalist groups scheduled for early, mid-September. But that can get tricky because we have a First Amendment. We have free speech guarantees in this country.
Certainly, that is true. Of course, colleges have some liberties that, say, local governments do not in terms of restricting activities on their campuses. And then there is, of course, the looming question at all in all of these rallies. And it is, of course, in fairness, only a question about the possibility for violence. Another issue that I certainly was very surprised by, but is the reality of the sort of menu of issues that local government officials have to contend with today, which is that while they have a duty, certainly, to allow people to peacefully gather and protest or assemble as they see fit, they do also have some responsibilities towards public safety. And all of this is happening as the country has, in many places, really committed itself to reexamining policing and how aggressive policing should be. And so you see all of these things coming up in local government conversations and debates about what they should do, what they should do to be prepared, and what they should do in the event that there are violent gatherings in their cities.
Of course, it got tricky in Virginia, where they have open carry laws. So you had people with heavily armed surging in there, and then the police and mayor there saying, look, if we had been more aggressive, we might have had a bloodbath.
This is certainly true, and that is what local government officials have said there. Of course, there are people who have been quite critical of the police response in Charlottesville. But that is certainly true. There are open carry laws in Virginia. And by way of example, in New Orleans, where obviously most listeners are probably well aware that there were protests for an extended period of time as that city prepared to remove four Confederate monuments in May, there is a local ordinance that actually bars people from carrying weapons at protest sites or political gatherings. And while there were, I was there and I certainly saw a few individuals who were armed, it was nothing approaching what you saw in Charlottesville.
Janelle Ross with the Washington Post reporting on how cities, mayors, and more around the country are preparing for the possibility of rallies in their own backyards. Janelle, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Of course, what got everybody's attention is Charlottesville, and in a big way. Saturday, it went all the way to death and a lot of injury there. Friday night, white nationalists, the kind of polo shirt and chino brigade, but with the torches and all the rest, walked through the University of Virginia campus with this chant. You heard it. You will not replace us. Sometimes Jews will not replace us. Here it was. Walking through the night with those torches held high, and here chanting the old Nazi slogan there, blood and soil, same march.
Blood and soil! Blood and soil! Blood and soil!
What is on their minds? Who is out there? Here's one in an interview with L. Reeves of Vice News Tonight, aired Monday. Christopher Cantwell, white nationalist, explained why he went to Charlottesville.
I'm here to spread ideas, talk, in the hopes that somebody more capable will come along and do that. Somebody like Donald Trump, who does not give his daughter to a Jew.
So Donald Trump, but like more racist.
A lot more racist than Donald Trump. I don't think that you could feel about race the way I do and watch that Kushner bastard walk around with that beautiful girl.
Who is out there? Who is in that crowd there in Charlottesville and across the country? I want to turn to A.C. Thompson, an investigative reporter with ProPublica. He's been covering the rise of hate crimes in America as part of a documenting hate collaborative series. Over 100 newsrooms around the country collecting and verifying reports of hate crimes. He joins us today from Reno, Nevada. A.C. Thompson, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
You were in Charlottesville, and we saw maybe a convergence there. There were very old symbols of KKK times and certainly Nazi time swastikas and rebel battle flags. But we also had the kind of chinos and polo shirt brigade out there, though, you know, with torches that looked a lot like and chants a lot like Nazi time. What are the threads that came together in Charlottesville? Who is the Is it a movement? Or is it movements? Who's out there, AC?
You know, I think what was most noteworthy about Charlottesville on this subject is that what we saw was a new group and a potent new group of racist organizations. So there was certainly old guard racists. There were some Klan folks there. There was members of the National Socialist Movement, which dates back to the 70s. There were members of the League of the South, which dates back to the 90s. But there was a whole raft of new organizations. So there was one out of the Northwest, the Pacific Northwest, called True Cascadia. There was Identity Europa, which originated in California. There was the Traditionalist Workers' Party. That's Matthew Heimbach's outfit out of the East Coast. And so what you saw was all these new groups populated by relatively young people, quite intelligent in many cases, and really coming from basically the political mainstream to this much more aggressive, much more fringe extremist ideology. They were very different than sort of the earlier paleo racists.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from ZipRecruiter, who understands when you run a business, you've got important decisions to make every day, like hiring. ZipRecruiter makes finding quality candidates simple. With one click at ZipRecruiter.com/OP, you can post your job to 100 leading job sites across the web and manage your candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to hire. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/OP.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the white supremacist movement. Who's in there? Where they're headed? How the country is responding? May respond. A.C. Thompson is with us, investigative reporter with ProPublica, with us from Reno, Nevada today. He's been paying a lot of attention and was there in Charlottesville last weekend. Of course, President Trump raising a furor this week when he said, look, there's two sides to this story, describing that Friday night march in the tape I'll play here as, you know, innocent protest, very legal protest. That's the same protest that we had the blood and soil chants from, and you will not replace us, Jews will not replace us. Here's the president at that famous, infamous press conference at Trump Tower on Tuesday.
You had a lot of people in that group that were there to innocently protest and very legally protest because, you know, I don't know if you know, they had a permit. The other group didn't have a permit. So I only tell you this. There are two sides to a story.
Two sides to the story, maybe more than two. This is Robert Ray, neo-Nazi, works for the white supremacist news and commentary website The Daily Stormer, which has run into all kinds of problems staying up online in the aftermath of that. One of the he was in Charlottesville this weekend. This is an interview with the Vice News Tonight this week. He said that his movement is growing.
We're showing to this parasitic class of anti-white vermin that this is our country. This country was built by our forefathers. It's sustained by us. It's going to remain our country. I believe, as you can see, we are stepping off the internet in a big way. For instance, last night at the Torch Walk, there were hundreds and hundreds of us. People realize they're not atomized individuals. They're part of a larger whole because we have been spreading our memes. We have been organizing on the internet. And so now they're coming out. And now, as you can see today, we greatly outnumbered the anti-white, anti-American filth. And at some point, we will have enough power that we will clear them from the streets forever. That which is degenerate in white countries will be removed.
You see just how far this still goes. Of course, it didn't just show up overnight in Charlottesville. This was all the way back the day after the November election. This was the alt-right website American Renaissance. Jared Taylor there on the alt-right site talked about the significance of Donald Trump's victory.
Our rulers are shocked, shocked to discover that white people have discovered they have interests too. That is Donald Trump's great achievement, to have been the standard bearer, even if unconsciously, of white interests. The sleeping giant has been stirring for some time, and Mr. Trump gave it a voice and a reason to act.
Okay, and here we are. A death in Charlottesville, many injured there, and the whole country just staring at what's going on. We heard the neo-Nazi there say, A.C. Thompson in Reno, we are stepping off the internet in a big way. And I've heard this a lot in the last week. We're stepping off the internet and into the physical world. What are they referring to?
You know, this is a tremendous taboo in American life, is to be an open and out racist or neo-Nazi or white supremacist. And so I think there had been a lot of trepidation from a lot of these people about leaving behind the safety and anonymity of the internet and saying, hey, I'm a white supremacist. I don't like Jews. I don't like blacks. I don't like Muslims. And I'm going to be proud to say that. But they are doing that. And you know, in some cases, they're facing pretty extreme repercussions, getting fired from their jobs and so forth. But the fact that folks feel more and more comfortable to do this is a sign of the growing strength of this movement.
Is there a – talk about the, what's been called the alt-right, and make some definitions here or draw lines. Alt-right, white nationalist, white supremacist, does this all merge into one? Are the distinctions?
You know, what the alt-right started off with what it was in the beginning was really sort of three factions. And there was a conspiracy-minded faction. There was a men's rights misogynist kind of faction, and there was a white supremacist kind of faction. What's really left now that you would really say is the alt-right is the white supremacist faction. And they will describe themselves as identitarians or white nationalists or other terms like this. I think for those of us who've studied these movements, that's just basically rebranding. The things that they're talking about are the exact same things that white supremacist groups have been talking about since at least the 1980s. So the notion of, for example, creating a white ethnostate or white homeland, this was something the Aryan Nations was talking about in the 80s and 90s. This is not a new idea. Most of what these folks are talking about is pulled from earlier generations of white supremacists. So for me, I feel like white supremacist is the correct terminology, and the alt-right is simply a new iteration of the white supremacist movement.
But talk about the new packaging. I mean, on Friday night in particular, the next day we saw a lot, you know, the guns and the battle flags and the swastikas, but already with the torches and the chants, it was pretty arresting, alarming on Friday night. But some of those young men, some of them with sort of almost Hitler haircuts, a lot of them were in polo shirts and chinos. What are the distinctions in the messaging that have drawn them in that, you know, make it feel more palatable, make it feel more contemporary? Like what, AC?
Yeah, absolutely. Like if you look at the previous generations of white supremacist groups, they were, one, incredibly dour and incredibly serious. They were, two, absolutely divorced from popular culture. They viewed all sort of popular culture and Hollywood stuff as being a Jewish conspiracy. They loathed mainstream politics and almost all mainstream politicians. This group, we're looking at a lot of college-educated young men, many who've been through the military, many who are very tech-savvy, and pop culture savvy, and they're appropriating from pop culture. They're saying, hey, Bane, the Batman villain, we love this guy. We're kind of villains too. Let's make him one of our sort of icons. They're saying, Trump, you know, we don't agree with everything that that he says or does, and obviously his daughter has converted to Judaism, but, you know, he's awakening the white man, so we like him. We're going to get behind him. And they are much, much closer to the mainstream than earlier groups. And also, by not, you know, dressing like survivalists or not wearing a bunch of sheets or not dressing like skinheads, they are able to talk to average people.
A.C. Thompson with ProPublica. Stand by there in Reno. Brian Levin joins us as well right now from San Bernardino, California. He's director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino, formerly with Klan Watch at the Southern Poverty Law Center. Brian Levin, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
What do you see emerging here that's new, if it's new?
You know, I think there are a few things. The first is that if you look to about a decade ago when this so-called alt-right started, which I concur with AC, I think it's the same cornflakes in a different box. There were certain things going on. Some of the older, more traditional hate groups got stale. World Church of the Creator, moribund, its leader went to prison. National Alliance, founded by the fellow William Pierce, who wrote the Turner Diaries, who also, by the way, like Spencer, wanted to intellectualize the movement. Richard Butler from Aryan Nations, he had passed away. So the older guard was gone. There was, it was kind of moribund, anachronistic. The Klan, which rode a little bit of a wave of anti-immigrant sentiment mid-decade, last decade, was hitting some obstacles as well. So I think AC hit it. A new younger demographic, more tech savvy. Indeed, Anglin's Daily Stormer really was outperforming the first hate site, Stormfront, which was founded in February of 95. So what I think is so interesting, they had a couple of things going on. One was they needed a charismatic leader. And I'm not saying that Donald Trump is a Nazi, but what I'm saying is for the first time, I think in decades, you know, even further back than Buchanan's culture war speech and this and that, I think you have to go back to George Wallace to see white nationalists just rally around a mainstream candidate. And I believe in that year, Wallace carried five states and got 44 electoral votes. So they had a charismatic leader who surrounded themselves with their accolades, like Messrs. Bannon, Miller, and Gorka, and the rallies were must-see TV. And I don't think it's any accident that Matt Heimbach, who manhandled disgustingly an African-American female anti-Trump protester at a rally in Louisville last year, who founded the Traditionalist Workers' Party, before that he founded a white student group at Towson State in Maryland, that he was one of the so-called luminaries that was supposed to speak. So it's a more geographically diverse group. We had several groups that had a big presence in California go to this rally. Identity Europa, by the way, that was the symbol on a lot of these polo shirts. Mm. And so they're white supremacists, but what I think is so interesting in white nationalists and neo-Nazis, but they rotate the symbology when appropriate. So they'll say blood and soil, and they'll carry tiki torches and wear polo shirts, but that might not be as obvious to young people that it's a Nazi-esque symbology when compared to a burning cross, for instance, which is, old Klan Confederate.
Yeah.
The swastikas, which did come out. So it's just like this shell game. And what I think is so interesting, for instance, when Nathan D'Amigo, who heads up Identity Europa, goes to colleges, he says he's an identitarian, not a white supremacist. But then with his cohorts, he says that. So it's really a shell game. It's different packaging. And what they're using is this fear of change that is taking place with many people as a wedge. And it's no accident that immigration, Sharia law, and Confederate symbols are that wedge that has become a battering ram for these folks.
You mentioned Matt Heimbach, white nationalist in Charlottesville this weekend. He talked here to Vice News, said he was excited about the movement's prospects looking forward.
This is the largest nationalist rally in over two decades here in the United States. It's incredibly exciting. If you look at what's happened, they've had to bring in leftists from around the entire country to try and stop us. And now we're continuing. We're going to keep having a great time, and we're going to keep fighting.
But there's all kinds of different language used. This was an interview with CNN on Tuesday. Jared Taylor, white nationalist, says he prefers the term white advocate.
A white advocate is someone who speaks up for the legitimate interests of white people. White advocates just want to be left alone. They would rather have a nation which was overwhelmingly white.
A.C. Thompson, we hear a lot of this, the language of white nationalists or supremacists now, sort of cloaked in, at the front end of it, it's almost like multiculturalism, where everybody else has their identity, we deserve our identity too, freedom of speech, and what about our identity? Just we want equal time, equal play here. I mean, then you get to the last line. You know, we want a nation which is overwhelmingly white. But the language of a multiculturalism is somehow woven over the top of this, AC.
Yeah. Jason Kessler, who is one of the organizers of the Charlottesville rally, describes himself as a pro-white activist. And that's sort of a message that he wants to get out there. That's another piece of rebranding that he wants to get out there. The truth is that he wants a white ethnostate with no people of color. But if you say pro-white activist, it sounds like, hey, I'm a member of this civil rights movement and I'm just, you know, doing what everyone else is doing, which is advocating for my interest group. I think one thing that is very smart on the part of this new movement is they have looked at the successes of people of color and of the civil rights movement, and they've said, yeah, we're going to take a page from that. And that's something that people in America understand, that everyone has rights, everyone deserves the franchise. And we're going to say, hey, you know, we have the same rights as everyone else, and that'll resonate. And I think that's been a very smart play they've made.
AC, describe in your reporting from Charlottesville just how organized this was. This also differentiates this from what we've seen in the past. Those people, the big march on Friday night, for example, and all the torches lit, the sort of – it was an amazing sort of just organizational display. That did not happen by accident. Describe what you saw going on there, AC.
You know, I think what's important to note is let's be real, is that the white supremacists on the ground, they outmaneuvered the police and the state of Virginia. They outmaneuvered the anti-racists and the leftists who assembled to counter-protest. They were remarkably organized. You know, for example, at the torchlight march on Friday night, I was hanging out at the park where they were supposed to gather. That news slipped very, very late. There were five people sitting at a picnic table, white supremacists. And my colleagues and I thought, hey, you know, maybe this isn't going to happen. Maybe these guys, you know, lost their nerve. Maybe they can't pull this off. And the second darkness fell, groups of 5 to 20 young men came from all different sides very quickly, very efficiently. They were all guided by individual leaders. They were connected by handheld radios and headsets. And in a matter of moments, they had formed up this long military-like procession and lit their torches and were ready to go. And I'm just telling you, it was a display of organizational skill and military efficiency that people should be aware of and be concerned about.
Headsets, people in contact, assembling sort of inconspicuously in small groups, pickup truck pulls up with all the torches, and suddenly, boom, you've got a big cordon. I mean, Brian, you got Jared Taylor, we heard there, saying, look, why shouldn't white people be able to, you know, get together and celebrate themselves as others do? He's quoted in the Washington Post today saying, what do you call a black person who prefers to be around other black people and likes black music and culture? A black person. What do you call a white person who listens to classical music, likes European culture, prefers to be around white people? A Nazi. He says, all non-whites are expected to have a strong racial identity. Only whites must not. Does that sell? Does that recruit, Brian?
It sells very effectively, but it's a fiction, because the reason African Americans have a racial identity is because slavery stripped them of their religious, national, and other identity when they were brought here in chains. So, but they're very effective in doing this. Look, when I went to a Klan rally last year, for instance, what were the signs? It said, stop Sharia law, stop immigration, and stop white cultural genocide. And what they say is multiculturalism and diversity is white cultural genocide. But most white people identify themselves by more specific identifiers, by their faith or by their ethnicity, something that we stripped many African Americans of. So it's again another false equivalency, but it sells well. And one quick thing, if you look throughout Europe and the United States, there's only one group that has an ascending mortality rate, and that's white folks of limited educational attainment and income, and they feel that they've been left out. And let me just say something, and I am not on the side of these folks, but having spoken to them, I think if there was one error that's been made recently with regard to culture and politics, is that they believe that they're not being heard, and they found that in the last election, so they took the lowest common denominator, but one who's happened to be talking to them.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking about the white supremacist movement this hour. Who's in there, where they're headed, and how this country is responding. A.C. Thompson is with us from ProPublica. He's been writing on all this, investigative reporter there. You can link to his reporting at our website, onpointradio.org. With us today from Reno, Nevada. And Brian Levin is here at the Center for Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino. Both watching all this very closely. You can join us. What do you see in this movement now? Is the president giving aid and comfort to white supremacists? What is the effect of that? And how bad could this get? How does this end? A.C., Brian, I want to ask each of you about, I mean, reading in the Washington Post today, this is Daniel Kreiss and Kelsey Mason from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. They're writing that the alt-right white supremacists now hope to, they say, poach the Republican Party's white base. And they're quoting Gregory Hood here with the alt-right Radix Journal, saying, look, that base looks ripe for us. They want to racialize, they say, the Republican Party's core group of voters, getting them to see race as an indelible feature of social life and white identity as the basis for group solidarity in politics. And he writes, yes, we know racializing Republicans will break the party as currently constituted. That's the point. And ironically, says this alt-right guy, breaking your stupid movement will actually do more to conserve the limited government ideals you claim to believe in than campaigning for Jeb Bush or Mitt Romney. What about the prospects for racializing the base of the Republican Party? Are we already on that trail, Brian?
Yeah, and thank you for letting me chime in on this. And just one quick thing, AC, thank you and ProPublica for the wonderful work that you all are doing. When Spencer, Radix Journal is related to Spencer from the National Policy Institute, when he was looking to basically weaponize this movement about a decade ago, he had two goals. One was more philosophical, one was more strategic. And the first one was dismantle the traditional Republican Party and the mechanisms and levers that kept white nationalists out, at least from sustained overt participation. So, you know, when President Reagan started his presidential campaign in the 80s, he did it in Philadelphia, Mississippi. But when the Klan endorsed him, he stepped back. Here, there's no stepping back. And the other thing that they wanted to encourage was the acceptance of white nationalism. And really briefly, one of the things that I think is so interesting, if you look at America back in the 20s, when the Klan hit its zenith, we were just coming out of an international conflict. There was the genesis of Marxism and communism. We saw a shift from an agrarian rural economy to an industrial urban one, the use of technology, et cetera, et cetera. It went from small town to something different.
Yeah.
And fear of change, and particular immigrants, and change of culture. In other words, Catholics were coming in, Jews were coming in, and the Klan capitalized on that. And I think we're seeing a similar thing now, a parallel thing, where people who are fearful of change and feel left out and disenfranchised, who normally wouldn't join such movements, now are like, wait, they're talking to me, and they're hitting a chord with something I feel.
But AC, what is the vision here? I mean, we are, This is not the 1920s. This is not the 1950s. We haven't had Jim Crow for a long time in its full flower. You know, we are a very diverse nation, and we are destined to become more so. So what's the vision here?
You know, and that is absolutely one of the things that's sort of propelling this fear and this movement is that notion that, hey, whites may become a minority in the United States of America. There are more and more people of color. There are more and more immigrants from different backgrounds. And we feel like we're going to be marginalized. That's what's propelling this. And I think you see two sort of main sort of threads. And one of them is we will create some sort of white ethno state. It may be America. It may be called something else. And we are going to, one way or another, purge everyone who is not white from this country.
That is unbelievable. We're talking – I mean, morally, forget about it. But, you know, that's 100 million. How many 150 million? We're headed toward almost equal representation of white and non-white in this country.
And yeah, and the I would say the other thread is that same idea with sort of Nazi hardcore authoritarian framework laid over it. So those would be the two main threads. And I would say that is the direction that these folks want to go. And some of them will say, you know, this is going to be a nonviolent thing. Some of them will say, like Chris Cantwell is a fan of Pinochet, the guy who was interviewed by Vice News, who runs the radical agenda. Mm-hmm. And he prints T-shirts that have a picture of a person being thrown from a helicopter with a noose and being hung out of a helicopter, which is something that happened in the Pinochet regime. And when he marches around with his folks, he says, we're going to take you for a helicopter ride. So there's a lot of people that are absolutely explicitly, signaling their violent intent. And other people are saying, no, it'll be okay. We'll get to this white ethno state somehow that won't be so horrible.
We've got to get to calls. We've been keeping everybody waiting here, and I'm sorry for that. But CJ in New Orleans, thank you for calling, CJ. You're on the air.
Yes, I'm concerned that no one has brought up the question of the motive of the young man, Mr. Root, who killed the 9 people in the black church in Charleston.
Dylan Roof,
avowed purpose was to start a race war, and it looks like the media and the politicians and everyone else have fallen into his trap, and we have now a race war. I live in New Orleans. And unfortunately, our mayor took down 4 Confederate statues that had been in the city over 100-something years. They were beautiful statues. No one had raised any problem about them before. And then all of a sudden, since Roof, they have to come down. I think the city and the state and the nation should take a step back and realize that we're playing into the motive of this young man who killed 9 people.
CJ, I appreciate your call. Brian, I know I have to let you go in a couple of minutes here. I mean, there are people raising some apocalyptic visions out there, the kind CJ is talking about. I mean, Robin Wright is writing in the New Yorker this week, talking with Keith Mines, a guy who's been in the U.S. Army Special Forces, worked at the UN, the State Department, navigating civil wars around the world. And he says, we keep saying it can't happen here, but then, holy smokes, it can. The headline is America headed for a new kind of civil war? Is that unimaginable, Brian? It seems bizarre even to utter the words.
I don't think it's unimaginable. I think it's unimaginable in the sense of what we had before. But here's what I do think, and because this is out of their playbook. First of all, there was a hate rock group called Rahoa, Racial Holy War. This is part of a narrative that goes back decades. Indeed, the Turnadaris, the book by William Pierce glorifies a race war, and it was used by everyone from the Order to Timothy McVeigh as kind of a folkloric template. And look what they think they're seeing. White Confederate monuments under attack. Christmas is under attack. We have all these immigrants, and they're non-Christian, and they're dark. And now the American population is only 61% Anglo-white.
Look at California. It's a bellwether what's going to happen to the rest of the country. And it even doesn't matter if their facts are wrong. You know, I went to a rally recently and a fellow said, they're imposing Sharia law in San Diego. And when I found out what he was talking about anti-bullying to protect Muslim kids. So the facts almost don't matter in this echo chamber where people in social media feed off upon these conspiracy theories and fears. So what I do think we're up for is, number one, more of these gatherings. We've seen more of these mega rallies in the last 2 years. When I say mega rallies, rallies of 100 or more, and the ADL did a great table on that, than we saw in the last 10 to 20. Charlottesville was the largest gathering of white nationalists that we've seen in decades, as we've just heard. So what I think we're looking at is now far right-wing extremism coming right up there with violent Salafist jihadists as the biggest extremist threat. One more last point on that. And this stuff doesn't happen in a vacuum because it's reactive. So as more people feel that they're being pressured and one group is in power, in other words, the thing that made the alt-right successful was they were insurgency. And now the very small folks who are violently motivated on the hard left are responding with a resistance insurgency. And we have black nationalism. Bottom line is we're talking about the most diverse threat matrix with respect to extremism in the United States that we've seen in years, and I am very concerned about far-right-wing racists taking it upon themselves as loners or small cells to do things like what we saw with the terror attack with a vehicle in Charlottesville last weekend.
Brian Levin with the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State San Bernardino. Brian, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a great day.
AC, stand by. Scott in Richmond, Vermont. You're on, Scott.
Yes, Tom, thank you. I am a teacher of middle school. I teach 6th, 7th, and 8th graders history and literature, and I teach a deep history about the KKK coming to Vermont in the 20s, and I teach the Holocaust in Europe. And what bothers me, Tom, is that many of these young people do not know the history of these movements, the KKK, the Nazis, from all the way back to the Hitler and the Bund in America. We had a Nazi party in the 30s. But the point is, what these young people don't understand is when they carry these flags or they dress in these costumes, they're portraying a legacy of murder and hatred that goes back, well, in Europe, almost a century, and in the United States, almost 2 centuries. And so, you know, the politics of the Confederacy, and, you know, I'm a historian. It's not that I don't want to see historical monuments brought down, but my problem is, Tom, that these young people don't know the history and background of these movements that they're supporting. And the history and background is one of a legacy of hatred and simply murder.
Yeah, Scott, I appreciate your call. You can hear those messages again. I mean, we heard them in Washington in November after the president's election. We've heard a lot about Richard Spencer in this hour. Here he was, and there were Nazi salutes thrown. But just remember, this is the kind of message that that gathering was hearing.
Within the very blood in our veins, as children of the sun, lies the potential for greatness. That is the great struggle we are called to. We are not meant to live in shame and weakness and disgrace. We were not meant to beg for moral validation from some of the most despicable creatures to ever populate the planet. We were meant to overcome all of it, because that is natural and normal for us.
Richard Spencer romanticizing white superiority there, and you might have thought, well, that's just nuts. But then here was Charlottesville on Saturday. You got people marching there with their arms out and a Nazi salute. Hail Trump, hail Trump. And you hear counter protesters as well. But here it was. AC, you've been covering these groups so closely. What are they thinking and saying now? What does the horizon look like in front of us?
Yeah, again, I think it's important to note that these are smart people in many cases, very bright people in many cases. And so they know that Donald Trump will have to make some statement that says, hey, I'm not down with the KKK. I'm not down with neo-Nazis.
We already said that on Tuesday, but in such an equivocating way that it didn't really land.
Yeah, and you know what goes beyond that is when he's saying, hey, you know, I don't know about taking down the Robert E. Lee monuments, you know, what's going to be next, Jefferson or Washington. they are very excited about this kind of line of thinking.
Why?
That's been espoused by the president. This is their message. That is what they believe. On Friday night in Charlottesville, they marched to the statue of Thomas Jefferson because the belief in this movement is that all history of white men will be wiped out in America. That is the belief. And so when the president echoes their message and says, yeah, right on, I'm thinking that as well, they are heartened by that.
But
they
Stonewall
know
Jackson
say,
and Robert E. Lee led a rebellion to leave, to break the nation. George Washington and Thomas Jefferson founded it.
Yeah, there's sort of this key historical problem, right, which is that folks have not really noticed that these are monuments to people who were traitors against the nation who led the insurgency to destroy it. But that's sort of been lost on a lot of people.
So what comes next? Do they have the organizational capacity to show up in many cities? Do they have the support to put out numbers? I mean, that was 500 or I don't know how many hundred in Charlottesville, more than we've seen in the past. What do you anticipate?
You know, I think there's two possible scenarios here. And one is that people may be chastened by what happened in Charlottesville. And they may say, you know, I'm not sure I want to be a part of this movement, in the same way that after the Oklahoma City bombing, the white survivalist and white militia movement declined. We may see that. I think what's a more likely scenario, however, is that I think that we will see a growing sort of movement that will exist on two fronts. And one front will be cyber. It'll be online. It'll be social media. It will be online networking. The other face that we will see, the other front, will be these sort of manifestations of street protests that in many cases are going to be designed to be a sort of street battle and get people's attention that way by having a sort of violent altercation.
Is there a correct way to respond to that? We've heard people say, you know, ignore them. On the other hand, this is white supremacy right in our laps.
Yeah, I mean, there's no correct or way to deal with this. Everyone's going to have a different approach to it. I mean, I honestly think that one thing, and I think Brian sort of hinted at this, that's important to do is to actually listen to people and to have a dialogue, because I think there are a lot of people that have legitimate grievances. They feel like, economic globalization has left them behind. That's a real thing. They feel like, hey, there's this opioid crisis and no one's helping us. That's a real thing. And so I think one thing that's important is to have these conversations with folks and to try to move ahead on issues that people can agree on.
And do it before it all gets locked into skin color conversation, AC.
Exactly. Exactly.
Of course, it already is about skin color conversation now. Maybe we've ignored too many things too long, but here we are. AC Thompson has done tremendous reporting on all this. The series for ProPublica is called Documenting Hate, a collaborative of more than 100 newsrooms putting together reports from around the country. You can read his reporting and others on the Documenting Hate site. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. AC, who traveled to Reno today to talk with us, we're grateful for that, AC, and thank you very much for your time and insights.
Thanks for having me on.
AC Thompson, fresh out of Charlottesville, Virginia. Listeners, thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.